This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Carnivore Club. So Father's Day is coming up, and instead of giving your dad world's greatest dad coffee mug, give him the gift of meat. And you can do that with Carnivore Club. It's a monthly subscription service where every month they're going to send you a box of curated, smoked, and cured meats from around the country. You're going to get things like spicy pork chorizo, venison jerky. Some of my favorite stuff they sent me was the cheek, which was like the cow cheek. It was really good, really tasty, nice with my eggs. If you want to try this at a discount, I got an offer for you. Go to carnivoreclub.co and use promo code AOM at checkout to get 10% off your order. Carnivoreclub.co, promo code AOM for 10% off your order. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So you probably heard of the paleo diet, primal living, etc. It's got a whole bunch of different types of names. One of the driving forces behind this movement is a guy named Mark Sisson. He's got a website called Mark's Daily Apple. If you haven't been there, go check it out. There's a lot of great content on fitness and just health in general. Anyways, Mark's got a great new book out called Primal Endurance. And if you're an endurance athlete, if you're on marathons, triathlons, do obstacle course races, this episode is for you. Today on the show, Mark and I are going to discuss some of the myths about training for endurance events. Some of those being, you don't need a carbo load, right? Have the big bowl of pasta the night before your event. In fact, that can actually hurt your progress and your performance. We also discuss how, you know, training for endurance events and how you probably shouldn't train as hard as you are training. In fact, you're gonna have to run slower than you think you should run, and sometimes you may even have to walk. Today on the show, Mark's going to explain why that is and give specific ways, examples, protocols on how to train, how to eat, what to do for recovery so you can have, you know, perform your best, not only perform your best, but enjoy your endurance sport for as long as you can. So great show. Make sure to check out the show notes after the podcast is over at aom.is/Sisson, where you find links to resources and things we mentioned throughout the show. Mark Sisson, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brett. Back after how many years?
Since 2009.
It's a long time, pal. We've been growing.
We have. You've grown phenomenally since then. Like last time we talked, your blog, Mark's Daily Apple, had just gotten started, all about primal living. And you're out with a new book for endurance athletes, for people who do triathlons, marathons, long distance bicycling, those crazy people who do the ultra marathons. It's called Primal Endurance.
And the latest one, obstacle racing.
Obstacle racing. I'm a big fan of the obstacle racing.
Yeah.
I don't like just running. I like being, I have my running interrupted with pegboards and the like.
I'm hip. I mean, if that had existed, you know, 40 years ago when I started competing at an elite level, that would have been my sport, I guess. But anyway, yeah. Here we are.
Here you are. Yeah. But so yeah, Primal Endurance. This is interesting because you're going back to your roots with this book. You started off your career, your athletic career, as an endurance athlete. For our folks who aren't familiar with that, tell us about your background as an endurance athlete. What did you do?
I was a distance runner, primarily a marathoner, and started out of necessity. I grew up in a small fishing village in Maine. I had to hike or walk or run 2 miles each way to school. And just figured that running would get me home faster. So I started running at, you know, 11, 12, 13 years old and joined the high school track team, wound up doing pretty well in the mile and the 2 mile events, rolled that over into college where I was captain of the cross country team, started doing road races in the summer, got out of college, was good enough at running that I thought I would train for the 1980 Olympic trials. So I spent the next several years focused on running, putting in 100 miles a week for many years. Got to be pretty good. I finished fifth in the U.S. National Championships in 1980. And I was down this path of human performance. But ironically, I started down that path with an eye toward improving my health and longevity. And as I got further and further down that path, it became fitter and fitter and more able to run faster and compete at a high level, I found that my health was suffering. And that was a little bit of a disconnect because I'd assumed all along that the more you ran, the healthier you became and the better your heart was and the stronger your joints were and so on and so forth. But that wasn't the case. So at the end of around 1980, I was forced to retire from marathoning. My injuries I had osteoarthritis, I had tendonitis, I had all sorts of injuries that had piled up, and I was getting sick a lot, and I had irritable bowel syndrome, and I was just a wreck, really. So I retired from that high-level competition and devoted kind of myself to figuring out ways in which I could be fit and healthy at the same time. And that's what I've spent the last 36 years investigating and doing. And ultimately, I came to this point about 4 years ago where I realized there is this convergence of technology now where we find that we can create the ultimate sort of high-performance athlete and not sacrifice health. And that became the impetus for my new book, Primal Endurance.
Okay. And what's interesting is that Primal Endurance, it shows athletes how to, like you said, be the optimal athlete, but it breaks or shatters a lot of myths. It goes against the grain from what you've heard if you grew up in the 80s and 90s about what you need to do to be an endurance athlete. And I think it's interesting too, like you said, you were fit, like you could run long distances quickly, but you felt terrible. But this is something that's common in the endurance world, or was common, is becoming less common now. What is it about endurance training, the way people typically do it, that makes them feel terrible?
Well, first of all, it's this, it's like a badge of courage to tell somebody you're a marathoner or a Ironman triathlete or some ultra runner, that people go, oh my God, what discipline you must have and what strength you must have. And that's pretty much true, because most of the time you're out there, you are managing pain. You know, you're struggling through these workouts, and you're going to the well in these races, digging as deep as you can. It's never, I don't know of anyone who's an elite level racer who ever says, oh, I was having so much fun out there, right? And yet you talk to elite basketball players, elite football players, elite soccer players, they'll tell you what a blast they were having on the pitch. But with endurance athletes, it's more of this stoic kind of management of pain. And it was an assumption that we all had that in order to race fast, you had to A, train fast, B, you had to practice suffering. I mean, that was really what it was like. In the mindset was, if I didn't suffer today in my workout, the workout was not worth doing. And so for decades, we went out and we put all these miles in, and we raced. We ran literally as many miles as we could at the highest possible level we could, with the heart pounding as high as we could sustain, and with the joints being able to maybe keep pace without getting injured. So it was really, what's the highest amount of pain threshold I can create for myself in my training, and sort of practice that on a daily basis, so that when I get into a race, I'll be able to, recreate all this pain, but manage it in a better way. And it's foolish to think that's kind of how we train. Now, ironically, we also we sort of understood through conventional wisdom that the way to fuel all this activity was to take in lots of carbohydrate. Because the understanding was that when you manage your carbohydrate intake and you manage your glycogen stores, that's how you become an elite racer. That's how you become better at racing at whatever level you're at. So that sort of begat this whole concept of carbo loading and all of the gel packs and all of the drinks, the pre-race drinks, the during-race drinks, and all that stuff was basically contemplated to get more and more sugar into your system so that you could burn more glucose and sort of put off hitting the wall for as long as you could. Well, those two things, the intense mileage and the focus on carbohydrates, and particularly on sugar, kind of overlooked the main focus of what we should be looking at with endurance training, which is, how do I manage glycogen by burning fat really well? How do I become more efficient at burning fat so that I don't have to put in a lot of carbohydrate, that I don't have to put in a lot of sugar? And once you realize that fat is the preferred fuel for humans in general, and that it becomes the preferred fuel for humans who are competing, once you understand this, you can then begin to take on a training program that reconfigures your fuel partitioning so that you get most of your energy from fat at reasonably high levels of output, that you spare glycogen, that you don't put so much of this inflammatory carbohydrate and sugar and grain stuff through your digestive tract and your body, and lo and behold, you become a more efficient runner because you're burning fat at a higher rate, and you become a less injured runner because you're not getting that inflammation, that chronic inflammation that consistently goes with the training. And because you can do so on slower training, and we'll get to that a little bit, and it turns out that we were training at way too high a heart rate and too fast a pace to become efficient. The only way you become efficient at endurance training is to manage your heart rate in a completely aerobic zone, which means at a much more comfortable pace. So now all these things come together. Now you become a better racer by training slower, strategically, of course, by adapting your diet so that you become better at burning fat. And when you become better at burning fat, you burn off your stored body fat. So now we get to the point where you've got an ideal body composition. So many runners I see at the beginning of a marathon, Brett, and they're like, seriously, dude, you got 25 or 30 pounds to lose and you're entering this marathon and you tell me you're training 30, 40, 50 miles a week. How come you're not losing the weight? Well, that's because they haven't become good at burning fat. So we're training at a much kinder, gentler pace. We're eating the sorts of foods that encourage us to burn off fats. We're getting injured less often and sick less often because of this reduction in inflammation and oxidative throughput. And it all comes together to make for a strong, lean, fit, happy, healthy, productive athlete.
Yeah, that's fantastic. There's a lot to unpack there. And I thought that was interesting, that statistic, because I've read that other places where they did a survey and they found that 30% of all marathon participants, like, they're overweight. Which is
that crazy?
And you think, like, these, like, marathon, they can run 26 miles. They're probably the fittest people in the world, but a lot of them are overweight.
Correct. And they're overweight, by the way. They're overweight because they're stuck in this carbohydrate paradigm. And here's how it plays out. You know, you train really hard, but because you're not burning fat at a high level, you're still burning through all of your glycogen every workout you do. You get home, the brain says, hey, we just depleted all the glycogen. We better build back our glycogen stores. We better eat all the carbohydrate we can get our hands on. So you carbo load that night. And then the next day you go, oh, well, I carbo loaded. I better go out and train again, train hard. And it's this vicious cycle. Well, the brain sort is telling you to overcompensate by replenishing the carbohydrates after a fashion. And it gets to the point where every excess carb that you take in raises insulin and is sort of presumptively going toward fat stores once the glycogen stores are filled. And you have this vicious cycle where you think, wait a minute, I just sweated off 500 calories today and every day for the last, year and a half. You're telling me I haven't lost any weight? What's wrong with this picture? Well, what's wrong with this picture is you haven't become good at burning fat.
Yeah, that's the chronic cardio that you talk about
exactly.
In the book.
Exactly.
So let's get into this difference. So the difference between aerobic and anaerobic training, because I think most people think, oh yeah, running, bicycling, those are aerobic activities. And they think of, like, lifting weights as an anaerobic activity. But what you argue in the book is that many endurance athletes who think they're training aerobically are actually training anaerobically.
Right. So we're always doing a mix of aerobic and anaerobic energy production. So at the very lowest levels, it's 99% aerobic, using oxygen to burn fat. So walking around the house, easy jogging, easy swimming, whatever, when your heart rate's just creeping up there, you're in a mostly aerobic zone. As you start to increase the speed, the pace, as you start to increase the workload, as the heart starts to beat harder, you enter a little bit more of an anaerobic contribution, and that is the burning of glycogen through a process known as glycolysis. And so there's a little bit of fat burning and then some glucose, glycogen burning. And as you increase the pace and increase the rate of heart rate, it becomes less aerobic and more anaerobic. And that's that part that starts to, the anaerobic part is what we see when we start to build up lactic acid and we start to get out of breath because we can't keep up aerobically. We can't bring in oxygen enough to just do this with an aerobic oxygen-based level. So where we see so much happening with endurance athletes is because they can train at a high heart rate, they choose to do so, thinking that at the higher heart rate that I can maintain in my training for an hour, hour and a half, whatever, the better that must be for me. But what it's doing is it's reinforcing this anaerobic type of training, which is that training which puts you into that lactic acid buildup phase that takes you away from the aerobic training. So the first sort of lesson that we learn in primal endurance is, where's that sweet spot where I can train my heart at its highest possible rate, but still mostly aerobic? And it turns out that it's a number that's proven empirically over the last 20 years to be 180 minus your age, plus or minus a few beats based on genetics and predispositions and perhaps your athletic history. But 180 minus your age. So in my case, I'm 62. So 180 minus 62 is 118. So 118 is the highest heart rate that I should be holding in long endurance efforts. If I'm on the bike, if I'm hiking, if I'm jogging, if I'm wandering around the house quickly or whatever I'm doing, 118 is that heart rate for me at which I'm putting mostly oxygen through my body and I'm not entering into any anaerobic contribution. Now, what a lot of people find is because they've trained so hard for so long that, and like I'm a person, I could, if I wanted to, Brad, I could go hold 165 beats a minute on the bike for 20 minutes or 30 minutes or maybe longer, but it's not efficient. At that rate, I am not burning mostly fat. I'm burning mostly carbohydrate, and I'm reinforcing that whole energy system of carbohydrate dependency, and I'm not becoming more efficient at burning fat. So with that 180 minus your age, which in my case is 118 beats a minute, that's the maximum heart rate that I can go at. Now, people say, well, Mark, I tried your program, and I can usually run 730 miles, but you know, when I limited my heart rate, I wore a heart monitor and I didn't let my heart get above, say, 140 for a 40-year-old. I was going like 13-minute miles. What's up with that? I can go a lot faster than that. Well, what's up with that? We just proved that you are not very good at burning fat. We just proved that you are not very aerobically efficient. So in Primal Endurance, in the book, we talk about one of the strategies for becoming more aerobically efficient is to limit your heart rate to that number for most of your base training. Don't exceed it. If you do, not for very long. And over time, you'll find that your efficiency improves. So that same person who was running 12 or 13 minute miles over time is now going, well, wait a minute. Now at my 140 maximum heart rate, hey, I'm doing 10 minute miles, or I'm doing 930s. And then a month later, wow, I'm doing 830s. What does that mean? Well, what that means is that they're doing 8 minute and 30 second miles, burning mostly fat, burning 97, 98% fat. So that when they go ramp up the next phase of their training to become faster and more powerful, if you will, they're starting at a much higher base of fat burning, which will benefit them when they get in a hard workout or they get a race against somebody who's not as efficient as they are. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. So you got to slow down to speed up in the long run.
I mean, that's the mantra. And it's counterintuitive at first, but when you understand the biomechanics and the biochemistry of it, you can see that if we're talking about becoming a more efficient fat burner, and if we understand that fat is this preferred fuel that we want to tap into so that we can better manage our glycogen stores and spare glycogen, because there is this science that suggests that once the muscles are out of glycogen, you hit the wall. So now if I'm running at the same pace as the competitor next to me, but I'm burning at the pace that we're at, I'm getting 80% of my energy from fat and 20% from glycogen. And that person is getting 40% of his energy from fat and 60% from glycogen. At the same pace, who's going to run out of glycogen faster? He is. Now, so if we go the same pace, he'll die. He'll hit the wall before I do. But conversely, if I want to match his fuel partitioning, and I want to go 60% or 40% fat and 60% glycogen, I'm going to be going a lot faster than he is from the get-go because I'm that much more efficient.
Okay. And so, I mean, I imagine this, when people hear this and they put it into practice first, it's extremely frustrating. Like, you might be doing a lot of walking during your
initial runs. If you're a runner, yeah. Yep.
Right.
Or as we say on the bike, you may be doing some paperboy up the hill. And that's zigzagging back and forth across the street with a bike full of papers back in the old days. I don't know if that means anything to your audience, but it's a cool visual for those of us who are over 50. I've had so many people report back to me exactly that. Wow, I was so frustrated when I first started doing this. It's like I wasn't going that fast. I didn't feel like I was doing much, but I'll tell you what, after a month of doing this, I'm racing faster than ever, and I'm not even doing any speed work. What's up with that? Well, what's up with that is you're racing, you're more efficient, you're burning more fat, so that when you do get to the high end, you've got more glycogen to spare than the guy sitting right next to you who hasn't been training that way.
This is fascinating. So before we get into the nutrition, because that's connected to this, let's continue with the training, because one of the other things you talk about in primal endurance that sort of goes against the grain of what you traditionally hear in endurance sports is this idea of strength training should be an important part of an endurance athlete's programming, and not just like any type of, like, I think most people, when they think endurance athletes doing strength training, they think maybe some barbell, you know, some dumbbells, some lunges, but you're recommending like barbell training, like deadlifts and squats. I mean,
right. So if you're a runner or cyclist, it would be those, the lower body stuff, the complex exercises like weighted squats and deadlifts. And the reason is, it's to develop sustained power. So what happens in a race, a couple things happen when you're competing, one of which is certainly that ability to produce energy at a more efficient rate and to fuel the muscles. But the muscles still have to have the ability to withstand the demands of increased output, whether it's sprinting, whether it's climbing hills as a runner or climbing hills as a cyclist. And what we see happening over time, particularly in the longer events, is that athletes may have 100% of their max power on the first hill, but then the second hill rolls around. And even though their energy production is reasonably good, the muscle fibers themselves are starting to tap out because they haven't trained for this ability to sustain power over time. And so we see cyclists who will maybe climb the second hill at 75 or 80% of their max capacity or max power. And then by the time the third hill rolls around, they're at 65%. So what can we do in terms of training to increase that ability to sustain power over the long haul? And what we do is we load those muscle fibers deeper and deeper. We put more stress on them in a short period of time through specific things that we do in the gym. For example, we might do weighted squats, and we might determine, well, what is my, you know, one rep max on a squat? And let's just say, if you're an endurance athlete, it might be, say, 100 or 200 pounds, shall we say. Well, then we take 80% of your one rep max, we call that 160, and instead of doing one rep and stopping, or conversely, instead of doing, say, 80 or 100 pounds, 20 or 30, you know, times 10 reps times three sets and then walk away, we take a hybrid of that, and we go, okay, 80% of your one rep max, we're going to do we do as many as we can right now. Do a quick 10-second rest. Don't even re-rack the equipment, or don't really walk away from it. Do a couple more. Maybe take a short rest there. Do a couple more. And we keep loading those fibers until we can't complete one more rep with perfect form, and form being the sort of main arbiter here. So what we're doing is we're loading the fibers, and then we're backing off a little bit, and then we're loading them again and backing off a little bit, but we're loading them maximally. So we are recruiting fibers deeper and deeper into that muscle tissue to the extent that those fibers become able to handle the power demands that may be called upon in a sprint halfway into a bike race, or a hill climb, a charge up a hill, or Heartbreak Hill at the Boston Marathon, or something like that. So these are we're training the component parts of what a race consists of, but doing so in a way that, rather than just practicing doing them, we are breaking them down. We're parsing the entire goal into its component parts, so that we're dealing with the aerobic efficiency, we're dealing with maximum sustained power. We'll talk later about sprinting and how we look at sprints as a form of interval training. And then ultimately we'll look at how the diet is important in reconfiguring how we extract fat from our stored body fat.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. All right, Father's Day is coming up in a few weeks, and dads can be impossible to shop for. You don't want to get another tie or pair of socks he's never going to wear, but you also don't want to give him something really practical that doesn't feel special enough to be a gift. Thankfully, Harry's has got you covered. While supplies last, Harry's is offering a special limited edition shave set for Father's Day. Get one for dad and for yourself too while you're at it. I love Harry's. I've been switching between it and my safety razor for a while now. And unlike a lot of the other multi-blade cartridges that I've used in the past, I don't get any of the irritation or bumps that I do with Harry's. Also, Harry's is significantly cheaper and they ship directly to the door, no more having to go to the drugstore and asking the manager to get his keys to get the cartridges out of that plexiglass case. So if you want to try Harry's out and get this special Father's Day gift set at a discount, I got an offer for you. Go to harrys.com and Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase with promo code manliness at checkout. Don't wait. Economy shipping for Father's Day ends on Thursday, June 9th. That's this week, so act now. That's harrys.com, code manliness for $5 off to get dad something he'll actually use this Father's Day. Also by Indochino. So every man should have at least one good suit in their wardrobe. You can wear it to a job interview, weddings, funeral, or just a night out when you want to get dressed up. You can go to the department store and get an off-the-rack suit. The problem with it, even after you get it tailored, it's still not going to fit you just right because that thing has been tailored and measured and cut in a way so it can fit millions of men with different body shapes. Thankfully, thanks to Indochino, made-to-measure suits are available to the masses and at an affordable price. You go to Indochino.com, you can get a made-to-measure suit and customize it however you want so you can get a one-of-a-kind suit that fits you perfectly. The process in Indochino is awesome. I got a navy blue suit, looks great. I got to pick what kind of lapel I wanted, the color of the lining of my suit, the type of, if I wanted a pleat on my pant or not, the way the pant breaks, if you want a cuff or not a cuff on your pant. And then you go through this measuring process that's super easy. It's all online. They have video demonstrations. So there's no chance for error as you're doing this. You probably just need someone else to help you out with some of the harder to measure parts of your body. If you want to try Indochino suit out at a price, I got an offer for you. My listeners can get any premium suit for just $399. That's up to 50% off at Indochino.com and entering code manliness at checkout. Plus shipping is free. There's no reason not to try your first custom made suit with this great deal. Again, Indochino.com, promo code manliness at checkout for any premium suit for just $399 and free shipping. Indochino, your look, your way. Now back to the show.
So how do endurance athletes avoid the risk of bulking, right, while doing strength training? Because, like, you know, on cyclists, runners, like, every little bit, like, if you, sure, you have more muscle and that muscle can do more work, but that's, like, more weight you have to carry around. So how do you address?
Well, first of all, so if we're doing lower body training in the gym, you're not bulking up on top, so you're not really carrying around any extra weight on top. We're not having you do biceps curls and, you know, and lat pull downs and deltoid raises and things like that. I mean, you can if you want to, but that's not the point here. The point here is how specific can I get in the gym in the weight training so that I'm building power and not putting on useless mass around my entire body. So when we're talking about doing weighted squats or deadlifts, we're just talking about the leg muscles. And you will not bulk up. It's impossible because if you're doing the work running, you're still going to be leaning out that muscle tissue. It's just that what we've done is we've worked on your power. We haven't worked on your size. We've worked on your power, right? So it's not an issue. Bulking up is not an issue. And I defy you to show me one cyclist who has complained about bulking up because of the work he did in the gym. Most cyclists, you look at their quads, even if they're not doing gym work, their quads are pretty big meat slabs especially the sprinters, because of that work that they do.
Right.
So nothing you do in the gym is going to hamper or hinder your ability to race efficiently. It's really about the power to weight ratio that we're developing. Cyclists in particular, they look at this magic number of 6 watts per kilogram. And if you can get to 6 watts per kilogram over extended periods of time, you're going to beat the guy next to you, given the same, equipment and everything else.
So let's talk about sprinting, because that is an anaerobic activity. So how does that help you? I mean, how does this fit in with the idea that, we want to build an aerobic base in our endurance training?
Right. So then sprinting comes in because a couple of reasons. Number one, sprinting is another way to work on that sustained power, that deep power. When we talk about sprinting, we're not so much talking about the old school of the intervals. And if you're a marathoner, you probably did a lot of half mile repeats or mile repeats or really longer intervals that we wouldn't really call sprinting to begin with. And it was rare, at least when I was training, that a marathoner would do 100-meter sprints or 200-meter sprints. Because it was like, okay, how does that doesn't apply to what I'm doing in the marathon. I'm never running that fast, so why should I train that fast? Well, the answer is because what we're training is we're looking at how can we get the most effective workout with the least amount of pain, suffering, and sacrifice. We call it the MED, the minimum effective dose. So when you're sprinting, if I can show you that by doing 6 to 8 sets of 10 to 20 second sprints, all out after a warm up, obviously you want to warm up, but all out, maximum effort, and then you're done, you might go, well, you're crazy, Mark. How does that help me with a 10K or a marathon? Well, what it does is it works those completely anaerobically, which has its own metabolic side effects that create the gene expression that builds power and strength and speed. But it also, it's working at the level of the structure of the tendons, the ligaments, and the muscles. So you're doing a lot of work in a very focused period of time that allows you to spend, shall we say, less time on the ground and more time in the air if you're a runner, or more efficient at pedaling through the entire barrel of the stroke if you're a cyclist and you know what I'm talking about. The idea to become efficient cyclist is to be inside this cylinder that you're always trying to pedal out of. So you're pulling up on the top, you're pushing forward in the front, you're pushing down on the downstroke, and you're pushing back on the backstroke. You know what I mean? So you're not just hoping the pedals get over the top and then stomping on them, but you're becoming more efficient. Well, all of these things, whether you're sprinting as a runner or as a cyclist, and it works for swimming as well, that sort of training is now preparing you for that efficiency of the actual work being done by the muscle itself. So not so much in terms of the energy source, but in terms of the mechanical force that's being produced by that set of tendons and muscles. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I imagine in the book, people can find out how all this training works together. You lay out a periodization, a suggested periodization program in the book. And what I love about your book as well is that, you know, you give prescriptions, but it's not overly prescriptive. I think the overarching theme or idea in the book is like, you got to just like listen to your body, do what works for you.
I mean, my goal here is to make people intuitive about their training. And so how we do that, or how I elected to do that, is through some education. This is how the body works. This is what we've learned from the science in the past 20 years that we didn't know 20 or 30 years ago. Here's how we can apply it if we want to. But ultimately, you are the best coach for yourself. And when you understand the ramifications of these choices you're making, and you wake up in the morning and you say, well, how do I feel today? I had this planned, but if I don't feel like doing it, I'm okay. Taking the day off, I don't have to feel guilty because I was supposed to go for an easy 15-mile hike today, or a easy 50-mile bike ride, or whatever. But I don't feel like it, and I don't feel prepared. Then great, now you've become intuitive, and wait till you're ready for it. And particularly true with a sprint day, for instance. If you're not firing on all cylinders on a sprint day, don't do it. You'll gain more by taking the day off and resting than you will from slogging through a workout that may predispose you to injury or may set you back because your immune system wasn't ready for you to dig that deep that day.
Okay. So let's go back to nutrition, because this ties in tightly with the training, because the goal with primal endurance is you want to focus on aerobic training, and that requires fat. It burns fat as fuel. So I imagine the diet we want when we're training on the primal endurance way is more fat focused as opposed to carb focused.
Yeah, correct. It's more healthy fat focused for sure. But we look at, what are we trying to do here? We're trying to force the body to make changes, to upregulate gene systems that will build a more powerful set of muscles, that will allow us to be able to access stored body fat and burn it more efficiently. That means building more mitochondria, which is where the fat's burned within the cells, making those mitochondria more efficient. All of this happens as a result of gene genes turning on or off in response to the signals we give them.
This is epigenetics.
This is epigenetics. And this is the key to everything we talk about in primal blueprint and primal endurance and everything primal, paleo, or ancestral. How do we harness the power of our genes through the epigenetic choices we make with the foods we eat, the types of workouts we choose to do, the amount of sun we get, the amount of sleep we get, the amount of play we take on? Well, one of the strongest sets of epigenetic regulators is food. And the very fact that we could eliminate or cut way back on carbs is a powerful signal to the body that, wait a minute, I've been relying on carbohydrates my whole life because you've been feeding me every 2 or 3 hours, and now you change the rules. Now you're cutting back on the carbs. You're not feeding me as often. You're feeding me more fat. I guess I have to adapt. And so the body upregulates these enzyme systems that are involved in taking fat out of storage. It upregulates those enzyme systems that are involved in building more mitochondria. The mitochondria have their own DNA. Those mitochondria respond by getting more efficient at burning fat. And lo and behold, over time, by having reduced the sugars and the simple carbohydrates in your diet, by having increased the amount of healthy fats and pretty much kept protein steady, you have reprogrammed your genes to become a fat-burning beast, to make you a fat-burning beast, to make you able to access stored body fat on a minute-to-minute basis so that you don't have to rely on carbohydrate at every meal. You don't even have to rely on 3 meals a day. Most people who are in this space right now are doing some form of compressed eating window where they wake up in the morning. They're not really that hungry because they're so good at burning fat. They're literally not having fasted overnight because the body's been taking its energy from stored body fat. So you wake up, you're not hungry. And I say, if you're not hungry, why do you want to eat? You're good at burning fat, become more efficient at burning fat. So a lot of these people who are doing this type of training don't eat until noon or 1 o'clock. It's what we call a compressed eating window or intermittent fasting. So they have their first meal at 1, and then they have their last meal of the day at 7 p.m. and starts that cycle all over again. But in between, in those 18 hours in between, they're burning a lot of fat, and they're training their body to burn fat. And that translates directly to how they access fat when they go out and do that aerobic threshold training. So it's a beautiful sort of reinforcement synchronistic system.
Yeah, I love the analogy you made about the book about between carbs and fat with the power plant. Like, carbs are coal, right? It's dirty. It can get the job done, but not very efficient, not very clean, whereas fat is more like solar power.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, and solar power is unlimited, and you know, fats are virtually unlimited. I mean, I think back to the original premise that we opened this discussion with, which is that for the longest time we thought that what determined your success in a race was how you manage glycogen. But when you realize that the body can only hold about 2,000 calories worth of glycogen at any one time, and of those 2,000 calories, 400 sort of reserved in the liver for the brain, that leaves 1,600, and the muscles will never willingly run out of glycogen completely down to zero. So maybe you've got, you know, 1,200 calories accessible for this race that you're going to do. That's 300 grams total of carbohydrate. Well, your body, you can store, even on a lean athlete, you can store 30 or 40,000 calories worth of fat, and in some cases more. And that's enough to jog easily 300 miles. Big difference there between these two sources of energy. So back to the more you can become efficient at burning fat, the more you can reduce your reliance on carbohydrates and this glycogen reserve that you have, the better you will compete, the less sugar you'll put through your system. And we didn't even talk about, you know, the sort of devastating effects of a lifetime of consuming high amounts of sugar.
Right. I mean, it's terrible. You can talk about some of it. Some of it's just, it's fascinating what the sugar does to our bodies.
Yeah. I mean, it's clear that of the 35 million people that are either currently diagnosed or will be diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in this country, it's that inability to manage large amounts of glucose coming into the body, whether it's from sugar or whether it's from even sometimes quote-unquote healthy sources of carbohydrates like grains and whole grains and refined grains and things like that. So the excess sugar is very toxic to the body. The body has a lot of ways of getting rid of excess sugar, which is another kind of red flag when people say, well, wait a minute, glucose is the preferred fuel of the body. If it were so, why would the body have all these mechanisms to limit the total amount in our bloodstream to what amounts to a teaspoonful at any point in time? And why would it allow us to store unlimited amounts of this other very efficient fuel that we call fat? Too much sugar is inflammatory, and that was one of my biggest issues with my heyday of the training, when I was consuming 700 to 1,000 grams of carbs a day to be able to fuel my 100 miles a week of training. It turns out that was very pro-inflammatory. Just the pure sugar that was in the drinks and the sweet stuff that I was taking in, but also in the form of the grains that I was consuming. I mean, I found in my case that I had a big issue with gluten and gluten analogs that exist in other grains, to the extent that when I eliminated all the grains from my diet, the major source of inflammation throughout my body went away. And that was life-changing. I mean, the arthritis that I had in my feet for 30 years, that went away. The arthritis that I just recently started to develop in my early 40s in my fingers went away. And I thought, well, how could that possibly be? That's just normal arthritis, isn't it? No, it was completely related to the foods that I was eating. So when you see the immediate effects of reduction in pain from inflammation, I mean, my IBS went away. That was a huge thing for me. So all these pain elements in my body went away that were largely determined by inflammation. I started to think in terms of the latest philosophy in heart disease, which is that heart disease is not a factor of cholesterol and saturated fat per se, but it's a disease of inflammation. And it's really the cholesterol that's acting as a band-aid within the blood vessels that's caused by the inflammation that becomes the issue. If you don't have the inflammation, then you don't have the issue. And I started to think, well, wow, that's maybe all of the stuff that was obvious to me from the inflammation in my fingers, the arthritis, the IBS, you know, maybe I just dodged a bullet here, because that same inflammation was happening in my arteries. And now I can visualize that it's not happening at all, because I removed those inflammatory offending ingredients.
Yeah. And you're right. During the 80s and 90s, the whole cholesterol fat is bad for you. And that's when the whole like low fat foods came out. I remember Snackwell cakes, fat free margarine. And now we have research is coming out. Even like what health organization with the government is saying that, oh yeah, like that's what we said 20 years ago. You can ignore that.
Well, I wish they'd say that, but they don't quite say that. They say, you know, maybe some of the research on saturated fat isn't as overwhelmingly negative as we've been telling you for 40 years. So they're slowly backtracking, but it's still frustrating to see the guidelines, at least by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the FDA and the Departments of Health, that are clinging to this notion that, well, we should still limit fats to a very low number, and we should still make complex carbohydrates the base of our food pyramid.
It's frustrating. But so to sum up, what we said here, nutrition, primarily you want to go fat. So we're talking about good fats here. We're not talking pounding back, you know, state fair corn dogs and waffle.
That's right.
We're talking like avocados, olive oil.
State fair corn dogs. I like that.
Yeah.
No, yeah, exactly. So we're eliminating the industrial seed oils. So we're getting rid of soybean, corn oil, canola for sure, and all of these industrial seed oils that have been permeating our food supply for the last 40 years. So when you buy a processed food, which I hope you don't, check the packaging. And if it has any of those offending oils, don't buy it. But absolutely take in avocado oil, coconut oil, butter, ghee, lard.
Nuts have a lot of fat in it.
Yep. Things like that. And then grass-fed animals, if you're inclined to get your sources of protein from animals, either pastured chicken, grass-fed beef, line-caught wild salmon, things like that.
And your carbs should probably be like vegetables. We're talking like broccoli, sweet potato. So you're not saying like, I mean, you do talk about in the book, you could go like no carb and go to like a ketosis, which is even like cleaner than fat, but you don't have to do that. You could.
Right. You don't have to. And that's sort of the next level stuff that we talk about, the ketosis. And I'm giving a talk in a couple of weeks on ketosis and, you know, how as an athlete you can use ketosis to your advantage. But it's a commitment. And I'm not even spending that much time in ketosis, even though I'm a big fan of it as a tool for enhancing your ability to burn fat. I'm a fan of cyclic ketogenesis, which means you go into ketosis for a couple of days or a week, then you go out for a while. And when you're in ketosis, you're giving your body those signals. So it's improving the efficiency of the mitochondria. It's doing a lot of good things. And then when you go out of ketosis, as long as you don't start cramming down, you know, sugar and increasing your carbs dramatically, you'll retain that metabolic machinery that you just built. So there's a way to, I was going to say have your cake and eat it too, but I wouldn't say that.
Have your olive oil.
Have your cheesecake or whatever. Not cheesecake. Yeah, your whatever.
Whatever.
There's a way to do this and get the benefits of all the tools and strategies that we're talking about here. You don't have to really commit to being in ketosis for long periods of time or for the rest of your life, as some people I'm talking to are. They're so enamored of it that they're saying this is the way to a really long life. To be honest with you, I just like to eat such a wide variety of foods that I don't want to eliminate so much from my diet that that my gustatory pleasure is compensated for.
Like gustatory. All right. So besides the diet and the nutrition, what other lifestyle changes should endurance athletes make to perform better?
You know, with a lot of stuff we're talking about in the book is find ways to move throughout the day. Every time you're moving throughout the day, you're contributing to your aerobic efficiency. So if it's a stand-up desk, at my office, all my employees have the option to get a treadmill at their stand-up desk if they want. So some people are putting in 8-9 miles a day of easy walking while they're doing their work. But find ways to move. Take a lunch break with your work mates. Have a meeting during a walking session. There's sort of the new thing among the WeWork crowd and the millennials is having walking meetings. Let's see. I get a massage once a week. I'm a big fan of deep tissue massage, so I get worked on, get the kinks worked out, get sort of actively stretched or passively stretched, I should say, in that process. I like cold therapy, so I do a little cryotherapy. I have an unheated pool every night before I go to bed. I might jump in the pool, spend 2 or 3 minutes cooling down, and then towel off and go to bed, and I sleep like a baby. Sleep is another important part of our ability to perform better. We only perform well when we recover and improve from our workouts. And sleep is that time at which the body is doing its greatest amount of restoration and repairs. So it's critical that anybody intent on improving performance manages sleep to the extent that they're getting 7.5-8 hours minimum per night.
Well, Mark, this has been a fascinating discussion. Where can people learn more about Primal Endurance and the rest of your work?
Sure. Mark's Daily Apple is my blog. Written a post every day for going on 10 years now. Primalblueprint.com is our e-commerce site where you can buy our books, get the endurance book there. Also, some of our healthy fats. We've got a new line of product called Primal Kitchen. So we have very healthy mayonnaise, the world's healthiest mayonnaise, made with avocado oil there. Those two sites are the main thing. You obviously buy Primal Endurance on Amazon and finer bookstores anywhere. So if you're interested in becoming a better at performance, whether you're an athlete or not, it's a cool new strategy and technology.
Fantastic. Well, Mark Sisson, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure as well, Brad. Thanks.
My guest today was Mark Sisson. He is the author of the book Primal Endurance. You can find that on Amazon.com. And also make sure to check out his website, marksdailyapple.com. He's got tons and tons of free content out there about eating, primal living, exercise, etc. You name it, he's got it. Go check it out. And also make sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/Sisson.
Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this show, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever it is you use to listen to the podcast. And also tell a friend about us. That'd be one of the best compliments you could give us. Appreciate your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.